You're listening to Farmington Voices, conversations about Farmington and Farmington Hills, Michigan. I'm Joni Hubred, and I am publisher of Farmington Voice. Today I'm talking with Ken Massey, who is a Farmington Hills City Council member, but also a scientist with unique knowledge to help us understand the COVID-19 vaccine.
Ken, thank you for being with us today on Farmington Voices. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us a little bit about science and COVID-19. Let's start with a little bit of an introduction. You have been a longtime resident of Farmington Hills, correct?
That is correct. A lifelong resident of Farmington Hills. All the way through Farmington Public Schools, graduated from North Farmington. Been a lifelong resident.
Then you are currently on the Farmington Hills City Council.
That's correct. I'm in my, coming to the end of my 18th year on that.
That's amazing. And that includes a term as mayor as well.
Yes, that included those two terms as mayor. And I obviously am very vested in the community and love this community, very bullish on it, and just glad to be a part of it.
Now, you also, and this came up during a recent city council meeting, you worked for a time for Pfizer, which is in the news quite a bit right now related to the COVID-19 vaccine. So let's talk about what you did for that company.
Certainly. By training, I'm a cardiovascular pathophysiologist, and I worked my first position after training was in the medical school at the University of Michigan as an assistant professor, and then I moved over to what was Parke Davis and became Pfizer, where I was a clinical scientist and eventually worked myself up to a director-level position, and I ran clinical trials, interpretation of clinical trials, and drug development in general for the company, and a number of the compounds that I worked on went on to be approved through the FDA, and that is actually kind of an exciting piece of my career. And now currently I work for Wayne State University, and I help my positions of one of venture development in the administration and a professor of pharmacology in the medical school.
You know a fair amount about the science of developing some of the compounds, and you have this expertise. Can you share with us a little bit about what it takes to develop a vaccine? What's the science behind all that?
I'd be happy to do so. And it's also, this is true for any drug. There's just some minor caveats that are slightly different, but every drug that is developed by a pharmaceutical company, many of them actually come out of academia. And that's what I'm doing with Wayne State right now, is the early work. And the molecules may be discovered. Their scientists are researching different areas of disease and different conditions and come up with treatments. Those molecules, that's in what's called the preclinical and discovery area. Once a compound is found to have efficacy, and again, I'm just going to reiterate, this is true for any new compound, so a vaccine or otherwise. They take it into development stages where you actually start rigorously testing the efficacy and looking for safety. And this is all way before it ever goes to human beings. It's tested first in a benchtop in various models of whatever condition you're looking at. And then it's tested in animal models that reflect the moving it into a living organism, and you're here again, you're looking for toxicity, you're looking for safety, you're looking for efficacy. Then it gets to a point where if that drug appears to be successful in addressing the issue at hand, an investigational drug application is filed with the FDA, an IND. That application is reviewed for safety and other information, but predominantly it's safety. And then the decision is made that you can move that into its first human testing. That goes to, and you'll hear phases, phase 1, 2, and 3 testing in humans. There are actually 4 phases, but the first phase is when you expose very low numbers of subjects to the drug, and what you're looking for is any indication that it would have an adverse response in a human being. Once that small bit of testing has been done, then it moves into phase 2 testing. Now you're going into hundreds of subjects, in this case, generally patients, who have the disease of interest or are prone to it, and then you start reviewing, okay, now you're expanding it from tens of patients to hundreds of patients. If you do two tests or two clinical trials, is minimal, where you demonstrate safety and efficacy and similar results, then you can move into your phase three clinical testing, and now you're going into thousands of patients being exposed to the drug. And the number one thing you're looking for is safety, and then secondarily, it's efficacy. When I say there are four phases, once phase three is completed, that and the FDA gives the approval to then go out and administer this drug to populations, it goes on the market, physicians can start to prescribe that medication, and that's when you enter into post-marketing surveillance, because the companies are required to actually track all the information. If anybody has a bad reaction to it in that phase four post-marketing surveillance period, that information is collected and then sent back to the FDA, and the FDA continuously monitors safety of that drug. So that's the, if you think of a chevron from the discovery of a molecule all the way through the end result when people are taking a drug, that's the overall process.
Wow.
And this process generally takes between 5 to 9 years.
That's my next question. Yeah.
And the going rate's about $1.5 billion that every approved drug costs to bring to market. So this is a long process, and it's an expensive process, and the overall focus is safety of the compounds. And then and the reason it goes on into post-marketing surveillance at phase four is because some really small side effects may not even show up until you've got literally millions of people taking something, and then some little nuances out there, and we have to understand those for future development. One of the things that comes into play here is the attrition rate. The number of drugs, if you get to that IND stage where they're going to go first in human, usually that's one out of about 700 different compounds that may get to the point where they get that IND filed. And then out of those, to get to your phase two studies where you're actually putting it in people, only one out of nine may make it to that point. So the attrition rate is very high, and that's one of the steps. This is going to come up in a subsequent question, I would guess. One of the things that happens here is that you want to do a study, and then if you see a marker that there's a problem, you want to stop the development of that drug, because you don't want to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars to develop something that you know is going to end. So they'll do a set of studies, you interpret the results, you design the next set, and then you do them. It's done in a serial fashion. And that's the reason for that is this high attrition rate. Most of the drugs die in toxicology, meaning most of them actually get killed in the preclinical arena, and they notice some kind of toxic effect and they stop the development. But that's one of the reasons this is such a slow process. It's been done serially.
Obviously, the process for developing COVID-19 has been a little different. So could you talk a bit about, in addition to the technology of it, what has affected or speeded up that process a little bit?
I'd be happy to. And this actually is a great question. Everything I just said, it's a really long process. Any company has to put that money into each one of those studies, and they do so to try and find out if it's not going to work, you want to stop it early. Okay, I just repeated myself. What happened in this case is that instead of doing everything serially, the Operation Warp Speed, if you will, at the beginning of that, there was a lot of discussion around buying 100 million doses from different companies. And what actually happened is that the companies had a guarantee that money was coming in, that if you hit successfully, you hit the markers that you need to do, they've already sold the drug. So that allows then the companies to, instead of the serial, long-term serial process to do this in a parallel process. So you were doing a lot of those steps at the same time. That shortens that process down. It does not cut any of the corners in terms of the safety markers that are needed, nor the efficacy markers. It just speeds the process up because you're not waiting for individual studies to be interpreted. The second piece of that is, and this is unique to vaccines, because once you have administered a vaccine to an individual, you can't take that back or take it away. So the phase two studies are in vaccine development are called phase two, three studies. So you know from your phase one that it's you have markers of safety in human beings. And then when you administer that in a placebo-controlled study, that's a 2-3 because you're already, you can't take that drug back. So that shortens that process even more. So that's the reason that companies like Pfizer and Moderna and AstraZeneca and are compressing the development time. They're not cutting any of the corners. They're just able to do them in a much more expeditious fashion. Oh, I was going to talk a little bit about the technology here as well. So standard, for years, vaccines have been developed with isolation of a particular virus, and then you actually duplicate that virus in often chicken eggs, and then you harvest the active virus. Now you've got many copies of it. They're chemically inactivated by some means, and then you develop the vaccine itself, all of the things to put into the injection to stabilize it, to make sure that you can ship it places and so forth, and then you administer that. This technology does not use an inactivated virus. The COVID technology, at least for the Moderna and Pfizer compounds, do not use an inactivated viral mediator. They use a messenger RNA. And this is something that is a little bit different because we have not used messenger RNA vaccines previously. So two things come out of that where people should understand. Number one, oh, if we haven't used it before, it must be new. And the answer and the response to that is no. Actually, mRNA, messenger RNA vaccines have been being worked on for three decades or more. The reason that we haven't used them is because, first of all, they're very expensive to do it this way. And you have alternatives, for instance, through the seasonal influenza vaccines. We already have a very set process for developing those. Why would you go to something that's exponentially more expensive when you have something that works? And secondly, we haven't had the challenge like we have right now in being able to inactivate the COVID-19 or any of its variants. You know, they want something that's a little bit more effective and easier to ensure effectiveness. And what mRNA does is once this vaccine gets into cells, it goes only into the what's called the cytosol of the cell. It never gets into the nucleus, very important. And it attaches to a small organelle called a ribosome that then produces a protein that stimulates the immune system to see it as abnormal, and that looks like the spike proteins on the outside of the COVID virus. So you're not actually injecting people with active or even inactive virus. You're injecting them with something that creates a protein that identifies then that as being abnormal. Our immune systems first start out by making antibodies to it, and then long-term we have memory cells that once the antibodies have started to drop off, those memory cells are already in place. And should you be exposed to that virus, your immune system sees any cell where that protein is being expressed or affecting the cell as abnormal, and the immune system can take it out and thus blocks the infection of COVID.
That's so interesting, the way that works. It's that feels like 21st, 22nd century kind of thinking.
And, you know, it actually is because this messenger RNA, messenger RNA itself, using this, now that we can make it in a less expensive fashion and start to utilize this, we have opened up, there's a Dr. Creech at Vanderbilt, who is a virologist, and he studies vaccines, and his view of this is that we are actually entering into a golden age of vaccinology using these new technologies. So it really truly does jump us forward.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the myths and some of the stuff that's sort of spinning around on social media about COVID-19 vaccines and this process. What are some of the things that you've heard, some myths that you'd really like to bust about this?
Well, first of all, first and foremost, I think we just talked about it, was the fact that it developed so quickly. Therefore, it was cutting, corners were cut in the development to get it to us faster. And that's not true. I mean, this has been the technology of messenger RNA vaccines and other treatments have been being looked at for, like I said earlier, the better part of 30 years or longer. All of the steps had to be followed. So the speed does not equate cutting corners and thus decreasing safety or efficacy. I mean, at least the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, in their clinical trials, in the first dose that you get, and it's a two-dose sequence, the first dose has shown that within 7 to 14 days, you get a 90% chance of developing immunity to the virus. After the second dose, which is usually given a couple of weeks, several weeks later, that goes up to over 95%. And in fact, in the Pfizer study, it was nearly 100% because the Moderna Pfizer did their clinical trials, which incorporated literally 50,000 people apiece. They were really, really powerful. So the effectiveness and the safety is there. One of the first things I've seen on, particularly on social media, and I would encourage people, do not look at social media. If you have questions about this, talk to your medical professionals, your healthcare professionals, and really, truly ask them. Ignore what's going on out there. One of them, mRNA. People are, I've seen this a couple of times where mRNA is mitochondrial RNA. Well, mitochondria do have their own DNA, and I'm not going to get into all the details of that, but this is messenger RNA, not mitochondrial or anything else you might want to put with the M. And because it's messenger RNA, the way that it's encapsulated in the little liposomes that it's encapsulated in, which is the technique to make it soluble, it can get into the cell cytosol, into the internal part of the cell where it can then produce the proteins that make you immune. It's that stimulation. But this comes to the second one. People think that, oh, you're injecting genetic material, therefore it alters our DNA. It's going to cause us genetic changes. And this is so untrue because human beings do not have the biochemical pathways or the enzymes to then take messenger RNA, reverse it, and get it into the cell where it can be incorporated into DNA. We just don't have those enzymes. Once it's out of its liposome, it will never move through the cell and get into the nuclear genetic material. So the idea that this can alter DNA is wrong. So there's some people out there that think it's going to cause genetic changes, and that's incorrect. The other people I've seen on social media that this drug will cause infertility, and they attribute that to all kinds of conspiracy theories, along with the drug itself contains microchips so the government can track you. This is just absurd. Those kinds of things would never be, one, they would decrease the efficacy. Two, our technology, as good as our technology might be, we don't have that technology. And three, the FDA would never approve anything like that. So, those are some of the myths that I've been seeing out there.
I'm really glad that you were able to address those because I've seen those too. And the one about the microchip is the one that just boggles my mind because it just seems like such an absurd thing. But if you see it on social media, people believe it. So I'm glad that you're taking the time to give us the real science and the real information.
And, if I can actually, the other thing that probably needs to be addressed is that the some people have talked about having allergic reactions to vaccines,
mm-hmm.
and that these vaccines can be dangerous in it. Well, ultimately, yes. There are some people whose immune systems have developed and they have significant allergies to other things as well. So people should talk to their, if you have something that you've got severe food allergies or you have had reactions to previous vaccinations, you know, those people are the only ones that really seem to have had any issues with that. And in the trials there have been, I think in the Moderna trial, there were two in the UK and I think one or two here in the US, but can all be related back to an adverse reaction because they had had previous adverse reactions. So that is something also, that these are safe. But if you do have those types of things, are prone to them, again, consultation with your physician or your healthcare provider is really key in making a decision as to whether or not you want to try this vaccine.
Ken, is there anything else that that you wanted to get across today that we haven't talked about yet?
One thing, yes, I will tell you. So what is a vaccine? What are we actually using the vaccine for? And people may have heard of the concept of herd immunity, because viruses have been around us since the earth was formed. Viruses, other types of chemicals, that's why we have immune systems. And these constantly evolve, and our immune systems evolve to address them. But the way we become less prone and they don't cause the level of disease that has been seen is when people are exposed to this, their immune system amasses a response, and then the next time your immune system knocks it down and you don't even know you've been exposed. In order for us to reach herd immunity, the numbers range from anywhere from 60 to 80%. The magic number in a lot of epidemiologies is right around 70 to 74%. People have been exposed and either recovered from or their immune system handled it. We are approaching, obviously, we hear a lot about the numbers. So a lot of people have been exposed. There have been some studies. One was in Stanford where they found that herd immunity exposure, antibodies, and so forth was as high as 52%. So to get to a point where we are not as affected by this virus, if we can hit that magic number of 74, well, how do the rest of us get there? You don't really want to be exposed just to see how you react to it. Well, that's where the vaccine comes into play. A vaccine is really a manner to chemically induce your immune system to see this as foreign and respond to it appropriately. And that speeds us up towards that goal of having the majority of us capable of responding. It's just like the seasonal influenza. We all have different levels of sensitivity to it, but if you're vaccinated, then you don't see as big an impact the next time it comes around. That's really what this is all about, is trying to reduce the impact on society.
Well, Ken, I so appreciate you taking the time for this and sharing your knowledge and these facts with the community. It's so important to get that real information out there so people know what's going on.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to do this, Joni, because I do think that if people can make great decisions when they have, I trust my constituents to make good, solid decisions when they have the right information on which to base those decisions. And the reason I spoke up at the last council meeting was because there's so many of these sort of misinformation going on out there. And, you know, I'm not going to try and change people's minds. I just want them to have solid information and then let them make the right decisions for themselves and their families, because people, that's how I trust my folks here in our community and across the country if we get good information. So thanks for the opportunity to do